listening to The Martial Brain, the podcast that explores the intersection between the martial arts, science, critical thinking, skepticism, and that wacky organ that floats inside our skull in a pool of cerebrospinal fluid, making life unpredictably inspiring, infuriating, and sometimes just batshit crazy. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. You are not the Punisher. The martial arts, self-defense, ethics, and the law. One of the most frowned-upon failures in sports martial arts is the failure to finish. Whether it's failing to knock out your opponent in MMA, kickboxing, or boxing, or to tap out your opponent in jiu-jitsu, sambo, MMA, or judo, or to pin your opponent in wrestling or judo, or to throw your opponent for an ippon in judo. Good coaches of martial sports will emphasize with their athletes that they should never leave the result in the hands of the officials. This is and should be deeply indoctrinated into the fighter by his or her coach. It is a valid and sensible doctrine for sport martial arts. But when defending yourself, there may be times when finishing your opponent can cost you a lot of money, or land you in jail, or both. Remember that in combat sports, there's a third person there, the referee, part of whose job is to prevent severe and unnecessary injury to the combatants. Of course, in self-defense situations, there is no referee, so not only must you defend yourself and your loved ones, it's also in your best interest to understand the law in these situations regarding making sure that you don't injure your opponent more than is necessary. Laws vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but there are common threads among them. By far the most common of these common threads will be the fundamental legal principle that you may only use an amount of force sufficient to defend yourself, and no more. A theme that I commonly strike in this podcast series is to be careful about allowing the more primitive parts of your brain to dictate your behavior. Or as I like to refer to it, letting the chimp get his hands on the controls. Perhaps no other situation provides a better opportunity for the chimp than when you are defending yourself. Remember that you are not allowed, at least not legally, to either punish or exact vengeance on an attacker, or to teach them a lesson, no matter how egregious the attack. Your initial responses to this statement might include, "But he started it," or, "He deserves whatever I do to him," or, "It's better to be judged by 12 than carried by 6. Or, "I have to be both a fighter and a lawyer. That's not fair." I fully understand why you might express some or all of these sentiments. I understand that it can be difficult enough to defend yourself without worrying about anything else, but the law doesn't care about how you feel. Let's pause to look at a few scenarios. In the first one, you find yourself engaged in a pre-fight ritual with another person. This other person has verbally initiated the situation and is shouting and gesturing at you. The actual physical fight has not yet begun. He has yet to actually touch you. Yet you still feel the gut-tingling dump of adrenaline into your bloodstream. Time seems to slow down. He approaches you with his hands up in something of a fighting guard. You reciprocate by raising your guard as well. He drops his guard for a moment to shout at you some more. Your ring experience induces you at that moment to capitalize on the opportunity and strike as soon as he drops his hands. Congratulations! It's possible that you just committed felony battery. You threw the first punch. Here's another scenario. There exist any number of techniques and drills for disarming an armed opponent. In the Filipino martial arts, it's frequently taught to use a knife that you have just taken from your opponent as a weapon against him, in a smooth continuation of the flow of movements. An example would be, the opponent thrusts a knife at your face. You deflect the attack, get a grip on his knife hand, and strip the knife out of his grasp with an extension of your other arm and hand. Sometimes, even frequently, depending on your level of skill, as you execute this, you're able to finish the motion with your opponent's knife in your hand. As you retract your stripping arm, you draw the blade of the knife along the opponent's former knife arm in a cutting motion, perhaps then immediately following into a thrusting attack. This highly efficient, elegant sequence of movements happens in less than a second when executed by an expert. It's important to remember here that many styles of martial arts are military in origin, and that there are completely different rules in combat than there are in self-defense. If the sequence I just described happened in self-defense, it's possible that your training took you in the course of fractions of a second from a legal attempt to defend yourself to attempted murder. It helps a lot when thinking about such scenarios to alter the attacker before re-examining the situation. Let's say you are attacked by a 5-foot-tall, 85-pound, 12-year-old boy who is wielding a knife. If you succeed in disarming him, you would, of course, not then stab or cut him with the knife. At least I hope not. How big and athletic must your attacker grow from the 12-year-old boy before you decide that you need to use the knife to even your odds for survival? It's in your best interest to make the decision logically and not emotionally. Understand when in the process of training if your tactics cross the line from the civilian into the military. I'm not necessarily saying here that you shouldn't learn such techniques, just that you should be aware of how to adapt them to circumstances. Here's another scenario. While defending yourself, you manage to get the opponent on the ground, and from there, you manage to take his back and secure a chokehold. As you are applying the choke, he forces out the phrase, "Okay, I give." Should you finish the choke? After all, most experienced grapplers have occasionally choked a training partner into unconsciousness. You see, sometimes training partners are reluctant to tap or submit, and such partners sometimes go nighty-night because their signal of submission might be your only clue that they're about to become unconscious. In such cases, the partner always wakes up unharmed, right? It's important to know, though, that a number of states have passed felony strangulation laws. These laws were passed with the intention of giving a stronger legal weapon to prosecutors in domestic abuse cases, where hand strangulation, or what some martial artists refer to as the rape choke, is common. But the language of the statute doesn't specify that it need be domestic abuse, or specifically the hand choke, to qualify as felony strangulation. A common legal wording for this recently enacted offense is, quote, "knowingly impeding someone's breathing," unquote. As anyone who has tried to escape a properly or near properly applied chokehold can attest, while you can still breathe, your airway is frequently narrower than normal, and your breathing is thus, quote, "impeded," unquote. I couldn't find data indicating how often this statute has been used when martial arts chokeholds were applied in altercations that weren't domestic violence. But I do know of at least one case here in Indiana where charges were pressed when a jiu-jitsu practitioner used a mataleon, or rear naked chokehold, to render his opponent unconscious. Unfortunately, I could find no information on the legal outcome of this particular case. With this in mind, it may sometimes be best to gain the back, then secure the arm position for the choke, and then begin to negotiate with the attacker, even if you think he or she deserves to go to sleep. Self-defense is hard enough without causing yourself the trouble that comes with crossing the line into committing a felony. Let me be very clear. I'm fully aware that most of you are grown-ups. I'm sure that in any given self-defense situation, most of you are going to try to act like one. I just want you to be armed with good information. Many professional ring fighters have adversely affected their careers and personal lives by not thinking enough when employing their skills in a street fight. Another important consideration is that your actions not only affect you, but others as well. If you are a breadwinner for your family, what are they going to do while you languish in jail for having taught a lesson to an attacker? If you do decide that it's worth the risk of jail or a lawsuit in order to exact revenge, then you should own that decision and not bitch about the consequences. I suspect that much of the natural human impulse to punish or exact vengeance on a self-defense opponent probably stems from our evolutionary history as primates in a dominance hierarchy. In such hierarchies, an individual fights not only for self-defense, but to protect or even upgrade their status in the hierarchy. This would probably entail making damn sure that any witnesses present see clearly which primate, quote, won, unquote, the fight. It's easy to see how this might lead us to possess a deep-seated instinctive drive to get in a few more licks on our opponent, even after they have stopped fighting. But if you value your freedom and your bank account, don't allow the chimp to get his hands on the controls. In the same way that it's a bad idea to leave the outcome of your martial sport bout in the hands of the judges, it can also be a bad idea to leave your fate in the hands of 12 jurors. Anyway, that's what I think. But I could be wrong. Let me know what you think, or check out old episodes of the Martial Brain podcast at my website, rpmartialarts.com. I'm Jeff Westfall for the Martial Brain. The Martial Brain is produced by Raging Squirrel Productions in association with the Rising Phoenix Martial Arts Academy. If you like the podcast and would like to help it grow, go to iTunes or Stitcher and give it an honest rating and review. Contact me with questions about the Martial Brain or the Rising Phoenix Academy at our website, rpmartialarts.com.